From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with Professor Tony Montero about the big story around the world, of course, the coronavirus, and particularly, what is the unprecedented exercise of government power being applied to solving the problem of the virus mean for the days when this crisis is behind us? Well, Tony, taking a look at the current situation with the coronavirus, with a number of other things, the continuing ongoing crisis of legitimacy of the various institutions, and now we're looking at such an advanced, you know, development of that crisis that people are saying essentially we're not going to have the Democratic convention, which was going to be a big showdown between the left and the center of the Democratic Party, as people like to refer to them, perhaps not even have an election. And this is a remarkable thing. And what comes out of all of that? I mean, these are huge steps that weren't even contemplated just a month ago, and under the cover of or as a part of the package of dealing with the coronavirus, regardless of what people think of whether this is a real medical crisis or not, or if it's warfare, coming with this are exceptional powers that are being used, whether they're being used properly or not, and the impacts of those are real impacts that are certainly worthy of discussing because they go right to the heart of the way we organize our society.
Yeah, and you know, I've talked about this crisis of legitimacy, and I talked about it with you for it seems like forever now. In fact, if you recall, we said that Trump's election came out of a crisis of legitimacy.
That's right.
And a protest vote against the neoliberal establishment by tens of millions of voters. But we're into something quite different right now. You can call it a crisis of legitimacy and mean by that a crisis of governance, a crisis of government, but more fundamentally, a crisis of class rule. Can the class of financiers, big manufacturers, intellectual and political elites still rule this country? Or will their rule collapse, which is in this articulation, the way I'm thinking about it, a crisis of the state. In other words, a crisis of class rule is a crisis of the state. If the rule of what we call the bourgeoisie, the capitalists, the financiers, the manufacturers, the intellectual and political elites, if that rule collapses, the state collapses. If the state collapses, we are then in a new and different kind of situation. Some people would say that we are so far from that that it's not even worth discussing. I would argue we are not that far from that. I'm also saying that it is not inevitable that that will occur. But if we are to understand the depth of what is happening, we have to speak of this moment and this situation in terms of a crisis of the state, sometimes, as I have referred to it, as a crisis of legitimacy. The other thing about this is that the left, seemingly in a state of shock after the evaporation of the Bernie Sanders campaign, and the fact that the Bernie Sanders campaign never reached the level that it had said it could and would. It never brought out the new voters, the young voters that they claimed they could. And being in this state of shock, a good part of the broad left, by which we mean the social democratic left and progressives and, I guess, left liberals, they are in such a state of shock that they cannot think clearly about the crisis that we are now facing. But it must be thought about, and I think doing what we're doing is the beginning of thinking about that. And once thinking about it, proposing what is the resolution to such a crisis, as painful as that resolution might be.
You know, it's difficult to parse all of these things, obviously, because, you know, we have, you know, the threat, the perceived threat, the actual threat, whatever, the public threat of this, you know, disease, this pandemic that's sort of coursing through the world at the moment, the sensation of the threat, the preparations, the mobilization for it, all of that. Again, I'm not going to lean one way or another to say how real it is or not, or how appropriate these things are to that or not. If this really is, in fact, something that could take hundreds of thousands or millions of lives, I'm all in favor of doing extraordinary things to prevent that from happening. I do raise a question, of course, why in a number of other spheres where that is an accepted casualty of the way we organize our society, with homelessness, war, hunger, lack of sewage and other improvements for people taking millions of lives every year and billions going back over the last few hundred years, we haven't seen it necessary to do the kind of intervention in our daily lives to ameliorate that suddenly we're doing. What it does do is point my attention to the fact that we are, in fact, taking some extraordinary steps that are not just extraordinary but unique historically. The command economy, the role that the state is playing at the moment in shutting down the most active economy that's ever existed in the U.S. to hear them talk about it, this is completely unprecedented. And again, if you look at the cross currents of timing with the election and all these other things, you have to wonder what in the hell is going on behind the curtains.
Right, right. But one thing for sure is that neoliberal capitalism is far more decadent, far more unstable than many of us had thought it was.
Right.
In other words, it was in crisis all the time. And all it took was, in the case of the 2008 recession, Great Recession, the mortgage companies and the banks and so on beginning to stumble over themselves in their rush to make some quick money. But this time it is a virus and the threat of hundreds of thousands of deaths and the need in order to save life, which they don't care about, but which the people care about. This is an interesting dynamic here. You know, people like Henry Kissinger or Madeleine Albright, you remember their statements about Iraqi children's lives were worth sacrificing for U.S. domination of that country.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
A half a million,
that's right. And, of course, Kissinger made similar statements about the Vietnamese. And although the same statements weren't made by Obama about Syria, they literally acted in Syria as though the lives of Syrians didn't count, not to mention Hillary Clinton and her crew and their actions in the Ukraine. So, yes, and even in this country, to save the economy, they are always prepared to sacrifice life. But in this instance, I think it is well to note that the people are so alienated from the rulers of the country and so ready to rise up against the whole thing that they had to take extraordinary measures to begin to do things that would save life. Now, of course, in this economy and in this political environment, the ruling class is going to put the interests of the banks and the big corporations first. Although they still have to do something for the people. Now, the $2 trillion bailout is going to be followed in a couple of weeks by another $2 trillion. And then after that, another $2 trillion, and on and on and on. But my point in the end is that the underlying foundations of this economy have been in crisis for some time. That the Friedmanite supply side trickle down, right. Neoliberal globalization, all of those words were words to talk about policies to prop up a sick economy. And that sick economy is on the verge of collapsing because of this threat to human life that has forced literally the closing down of the economy and unemployment that could approach 30, 35, and who knows what percentage. I mean, this is a big crisis, to put it mildly, but it occurs on the foundations of an already shaky economy, an economy that is systemically in crisis and has been maybe for three decades.
So do you think that the scale of the actions that are being taken, again, in particular, the intervention in the economy, mm-hmm. in some ways is extraordinary, right. Historically. This is an acknowledgement of, or a measure by the elite of the depth of the crisis that, you know, we hate to do this more than anybody, and we never did do it, but things are so bad, we got to do this now. Do you think it's like mm-hmm. that kind of a dynamic?
Yeah, that's what I think. And I think that the threat is a threat to their rule.
Right.
In other words, they are not, they're not adverse to sacrificing life, and they're going to sacrifice life. I mean, you know, life is sacrificed to the virus because the healthcare system had been diminished,
right.
because of the thinking of the neoliberal policymakers who said that we need fewer beds, we need fewer everything,
right. for decades
to make more profit.
They've been closing hospitals and selling them off for condos. You know, I mean, we saw Andy Cuomo. It looked like he was shining for a moment a couple weeks ago until people pointed out he's one of the people that presided over the, you know, the decimation, yeah. of the hospital system in New York State over the last 20, 30 years, as did his father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so here we are.
Right.
What do things look like going forward? And I think, like you said, I mean, we're not going to have the political party conventions. If we don't have the conventions, how do the Democrats in particular choose their nominee, or will it be a coronation? And possibly, if we don't have conventions, will we have an election,
right.
in November? And if we don't have an election, how will
what
that be under?
Right.
That's right. And how will that be understood by the masses of people, in particular, the working class? Now, all of this will occur on the foundation of an economy in depression.
Right. It'll be, I mean, you know, they're creating the form almost for a command economy. And,
well, yes,
and in addition to this, by the way, you know, we mentioned that talking about not having a Democratic convention. Suppose they have a fake convention for the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. You know, we assume Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, because if they had a regular Republican primary, he would win it hands down, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all
mm-hmm.
of the data indicates that there's not a serious challenger to him, again, as there really wasn't back in 2016. You know,
well,
the whole institutional group, you know, inside the Republican Party had been thoroughly discredited, including by the 2008-2009 crash. But, you know, over 20, 30, 40 years, like the Democrats, and which is the reason, the same reason Hillary didn't get elected is the reason that Trump was the one that won the night. Well, now, if suddenly you don't have a primary and you have the party regulars concocting some sort of scheme and you have an emergency situation in governance, what's to stop the election from being an election between, say, Biden and Mitch Romney?
Wow, that is, I don't know.
Right.
And what will that mean to the Trump base?
What will that mean because, to all of us?
Yeah, to all of us. I think that going forward, all efforts of progressive forces, and, you know, sometimes it's hard to know who they are, have to be directed to the grassroots, to the rank and file in labor, to the masses of people. Already the people are drawing their own conclusions. We have to be a part of that. I mean, the struggle for ideological and political clarity has to go forward at this time. For the activists and revolutionary and progressive activists, we are going to have to go into a situation as soon as we can get out of the house, and even before that with live streaming and stuff, of constant town hall meetings. Yeah. The churches, the community centers, and other public places are going to have to be regular meetings and town halls of the people. I'm a Philadelphian, and we have a lot to straighten out in this city. And such things as, will people be responsible for paying their utility bills? Will they be responsible for paying back rent? Let us say when the economy gets going again. How will we tax the big corporations and the universities to fund public education? I think we're going to be looking at, if not a totally new society, we are going to be looking at the possibility of a new society in formation. And this will be a long process. It will not be overnight. I think the other thing that we have to avoid is overstating what the situation is. I mean, and you're going to have really ultra-leftists who will take the people's activation and attempt to reshape the politics and social realities. A lot of people are going to say, well, this is a revolutionary situation. And in the process of declaring it a revolutionary situation, disrupt every effort of a step-by-step realignment and reuniting of the people, ultimately to create local situations of people's power that will eventuate in, you know, what I would call a people's democracy and a people's democratic state.
Yeah, you're talking about, in essence, like the phenomenon that took place in Russia, specific to that historical period, first couple of Soviets, which evolved into a system of organizing the society. And these, there are all kinds of prototypes that are, that look at the Occupy movement, quote unquote, for example, when they were relying on the General Assembly model. Look at the Jamahiriya in Libya. There's a million different models, CDRs in Cuba, and
all of this stuff. Cuba, similar developments in Venezuela.
And as you
pointed out, the economy, in a lot of ways, is in the process of being socialized, but it's under the rule of the capitalist class.
Right, that's right.
But that structure, that socialization of the economy, can even go further under the rule of the people.
Right.
And
that's right.
Such things have to be imagined, have to be thought through. We will have to understand the state. We'll have to understand the U.S. state, which is the largest, most sophisticated state probably in human history, yeah, with all of the technology, with all of the instruments of propaganda and information. Capital. Yeah, and then capital. And by the number of people that I estimate upwards of maybe 40 million people directly work for the state, the central
right.
state.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge operation, and it's not going to be transformed easily, but it must be transformed, and its transformation must begin at the base of society with the masses, and in particular with the working people.
You know, I'm looking at the sunsetting of the immediate crisis. You know, there are several ways that this can play out. A week or two or three or five, you know, Chuck Schumer and Trump can haggle over how long that is. But sometime over the next few weeks or month or so, there's an all clear whistle of blows, and, you know, the coronavirus fades into the background with all of the other various new diseases that have popped up. Do we go back to normal? And how do we go back to normal from that period? Is this, you know, you've heard socially and in terms of programming, the new normal. But, you know, everybody goes back to whatever jobs are still left, and then there's going to be programs to mediate this and et cetera, et cetera. There's going to be some real substantive changes in both the political consciousness of the country right. and also the institutional consciousness of the country, because all of a sudden, yes, when there is an emergency that's costing lives, the government can step into the economy and turn it off, let alone make a modification, you know, in large here, there, or somewhere else. You can actually tell people you cannot leave your house. You can't go to work. You can't do any of these things. And also, we're suspending all the restrictions on things. Yes, you can sell liquor and deliver it to people's homes. You know, all of the things. In other words, the state that people are so afraid of evolving in a socialist country, you know, the absolute, the omnipotent state, actually exists. And the minute that they needed it to protect their position, they rolled it out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And now they'll have done it, and it's going to have looked beneficial, and perhaps have been beneficial. And then they put it back on the shelf. People are going to be looking at that differently.
Yeah. Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. People, as you point out, people have seen that in emergencies, the state is the central organ of transformation. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And they will, after the virus, in the rebuilding of the economy, expect the state to continue to play that role, including, which a thing that they don't really like to do, except in crises, the printing of money.
Right.
And the taxing of the wealthiest banks and corporations in the country. And there's going to have to be, in the face of this, a discussion of the nationalization of the big pharma and what we will really do about health care and indebtedness of the people, be it student debt or consumer debt or mortgage debt. I mean, you know, I say all of this, it's not to be, not to try to predict what things will be like, but to suggest the parameters
That's right.
thinking among the people. And the people will be thinking in one way, the rich corporations and banks will be thinking in another way. And I'm, you know, the people are not up for being pushed around and bullied by them at this time.
That's right.
And if they go too far, people are going to demand the nationalization of banks, the appropriation of their money, and the use of that to rebuild people's lives. Everything is on the table at this time. Everything.
Yes.
The minimum wage, taxing the rich, universal health care for everybody.
Right. Yeah.
Everything is on the table.
I mean, it's one example. You say universal health care, for example, right? Yeah. Right now, what the government is saying that they're going to do is if you go to the hospital, whether you have insurance or not, if you have money or not, if you have this disease, go to the hospital, get treated, whatever it costs, we got it.
That's right.
Because this is a public health emergency. Well, we've had a public health emergency for a long time, and when this little disease goes away, and you still got, you know, a million people a month or a year or whatever that are dying from all the other crap that's out there not being treated, somebody's going to point that out. And the victims of that, they're an actual constituency in the body politic, a rather large one. And as you start accumulating members in that class with the knowledge that, oh, wow, all they have to do is sign a piece of paper and make health care available to people, they're going to start demanding it.
Absolutely. It's not that complicated. And this is part of the positive function of a crisis. Like this is that things become clearer to everybody. You reminded me that a well-known writer titled an article called something to the effect of let's get this class struggle started.
Right.
Well, where has he been?
Right. Right.
The very fact that that we're in a crisis of governance and a crisis of rule is a recognition, a derivative, I should say, of the class struggle itself.
That's right.
You know, question is whether the class struggle in this time will manifest itself in rebellion and so on.
Right. What will the in other words, what's the resolution of it going to be? Is there going to be a resolution of it? Are we going to have the same class tensions? Are they going to be dampened, you know, or numbed with drugs or television or whatever? Are the people going to be slowly ground into the ground anesthetized and everything else and confused and befuddled? Are they going to figure out a solution to the problem and raise up our species, basically, and prepare for the next 1,000 years or whatever to develop ourselves in the best and healthiest way possible, and taking all of the resources that have been accumulated over the history of our species and using those to invest in ourselves and to build ourselves up.
And you know, I can tell you, Don, here in Philadelphia in the Saturday Free School, we have already defined our task going forward, and it's precisely that.
Yep. Yeah.
It is to join with the people. And, you know, we work in churches and unions and youth organizations and student organizations, and we're going to be out there. We're out there already talking and being a part of this great political realignment, which is inevitable at this time. And you know, Don, you know, we've been into this discussion, is Trump a fascist or not a fascist? Are we on the cusp of fascism or not? Well, I would suggest this, that the political realignment that is occurring and will continue after the virus subsides, the political realignment will not be to the right. It will be to the left.
That's right.
And so there it is.
That's it. All right, Tony, thank you very much. And by the way, next week I'd like to discuss the Philadelphia Free School some. I sat in over a Facebook broadcast over the weekend on a long discussion that you guys had about Du Bois and some other things, and I'd like to share that. So maybe we could begin with that next week.
And let me just announce that starting next Sunday, in cooperation with the Central Branch of the Free Library, we are going to have a 4-week series of discussions and lectures on philosophy from Descartes to Du Bois, Baldwin, and Martin Luther King.
Excellent.
And we're dedicating that series of lectures to the 150th anniversary of the birth of Lenin.
Excellent. All right. So we'll talk about that next week. Tony, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks. for listening.